For those of you who were conscious during the 60s, you may remember that we came to a worldwide consensus. Maybe the first time in history that everyone in the world agreed that we had discovered the solution to the world's problems. It's very simple. We all agreed we'd come to this conclusion. The most difficult problem that ever existed in the world could be resolved if everyone would just join hands around one single theme. You may remember that theme summed up in the words, lyrics of Hal David in the tune of Burt Bacharach. What the world needs now is love, sweet love. It's the only thing that there's just too little of. And then the song that I even liked better personally, till they made a commercial out of it, I'd like to build the world a home and furnish it with love, grow apple trees and honeybees and snow white turtle doves. Do you remember the song? Until the Coca-Cola bottling company captured it and threw I'd like to buy the world a Coke and keep it company. Up until then, the theme was consistent, and it was true, wasn't it? That if the world would just love, if everyone would just hold hands and start loving one another, all the problems of the world would be solved. Such a simple solution to all the world's problems. I wonder this morning if I, as a minister in a church, could beg to differ with that. You know, it's love. I mean, how can you argue with love in a church? I think what the world needs now, and the world's always needed, more than love is truth. Without truth, love can't get you anywhere. The world needs truth. The church needs love. You see, the church has the truth. What the church lacks is the love. The world doesn't have either, and it needs to start with the truth. Listen to the words of Jesus to the church. In John chapter 13, starting with verse 31, Jesus is speaking to his disciples. And this is the last chance that Jesus is going to have to address his disciples before he leaves to go to the cross. In fact, he's got them for a very short time, a few hours in the upper room, and he's telling them everything that they need to know. Now, these guys are freaking out. They're thinking to themselves, there's no possible way that we can survive in this world without you. Jesus is telling, I'm leaving, and they're saying, there's no way. If you leave, it's over. There's no way we can survive without you. And Jesus says to his disciples, not only will you survive in this world, but you can also thrive in this world. And I'm going to give you the instructions that will help you do that. Jesus tells his disciples, this is how to be Jesus' disciple in a world without Jesus. This is how you do it. Listen, verse 31. When he was gone, that is Judas is going out to betray Jesus. Jesus said, now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will glorify the Son in himself and will glorify him at once. My children, I will be with you only a little longer. You will look for me, and just as I told the Jews, so I tell you now, where I am going, you cannot come. A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, all men will know that you are my disciples if you love one another. Simon Peter asked him, Lord, where are you going? Jesus replied, where I am going, you cannot follow now, but you will follow later. Peter asked, Lord, why can't I follow you now? I will lay down my life for you. Then Jesus answered, will you really lay down your life for me? I tell you the truth, before the rooster crows, you will disown me three times. In this passage of Scripture, Jesus gives the marching orders to the church. And the marching orders revolve around love. We see in this passage, first of all, Jesus sets himself forward as the true example of the sacrificial lover. If you really want to see what real love looks like, take a look at Jesus, and Jesus presents himself as the sacrificial lover. In verse 31, Judas is gone now, and Jesus says, "Now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will glorify the Son in himself and will glorify him at once." Now, the timing is now. In fact, Jesus uses a strange and unusual phrase to summarize this. He says, the glory, which always refers to the death and resurrection, the glory is happening now. And he uses a past tense word to describe something that hasn't yet happened. He says, it's just as good as if it's already happened. And the glory is going to come to me, and the glory is going to come to the Father. And you say, well, Tim, how is that glory self-sacrificial? How can you say that Jesus is going to give the self-sacrificial love if it's going to bring glory to himself? Do you remember what Jesus is talking about? When Jesus talks about glory in the New Testament, he's talking about the cross. And it's going to be at the cross that Jesus is going to receive the accolades, the glory. What will Jesus be doing at the cross? At the cross, Jesus will be dying for the sins of the world. He will be sacrificing his own life, experiencing the pain of the punishment for sin, and he will be doing that for the world. It's a selfless love. It's a self-sacrificial love. You say, well, how does that bring glory? Well, here's how it brings glory. God has been telling throughout the history of mankind that he's an incredible kind of a God. Not just powerful, not just wise, but he's a God of justice. That is, God does not let sin go unpunished. And at the cross, God is going to demonstrate that his justice is fully carried out by putting the death sentence on Jesus Christ. So we know for all times that God is not the kind of God who lets sin go unpunished. He punished sin in Jesus Christ. But God's not only a God of justice, he said that he's a God of love. Throughout the history of the world, God has been saying, look at me, I'm a God of love. And there God loves so much that he's willing to set his Son up as a sacrifice to die for the people in the world, to die for you and me. God is demonstrating he's a God of love. God has also said, I'm a God of mercy and a God of grace. Here on the cross, Jesus will be hanging there, and he will look down at the guards below him, and he'll say, Father, forgive them because they don't know what they're doing. And in those words, that summarizes Jesus' attitude toward the world. Jesus is extending grace, the grace of the Father, the mercy of the Father, even to the people who are punishing him and torturing him. You see, on the cross, God was showing the whole world just how incredible he really is. And he was doing that through the sacrifice of his Son. You see, God's glory is demonstrated in his character, and we never see his character more clearly than we do on the day that Jesus dies in our place. Now that is self-sacrificial love. Jesus is willing to endure the hostility. He's willing to endure the pain. He's willing to endure the rejection. He's even willing to endure the separation that he has with the Father. As the Son goes black on the cross, symbolic of the fact that God cannot even look on his own Son because now his Son is carrying the sins of the world. And Jesus is willing to endure all that for a group of people like you and like me. Now that is self-sacrificial love. And Jesus is saying, I'm the model. I'm the model of real love. Then he turns to his disciples and he calls them to a selfless love. Verse 33 says, my children, I will be with you only a little longer. Literally, only a few more hours. He's going to be leaving them in a few more hours to go to the cross. He says, you will look for me just as I told the Jews, so I tell you now, where I am going, you cannot come. Where are you going, Jesus? I'm going to martyrdom, I'm going to death, and I'm going to resurrection. You can't come with me. I got to do this alone. Then he turns to his disciples and he lays this out for them. He says, a new command I give you, love one another. Now you may say, wait a minute. As I'm sure the disciples saw it in their mind, why are you saying a new command? Haven't we always been commanded to love one another? back from Leviticus chapter 19, verse 18, when the law gave them the instructions to love your neighbor as yourself. Weren't we always commanded to love one another? What's new about this new command? When they asked Jesus, what is the greatest of the commandments? What did he say? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and do what? Love your neighbor as yourself. What's so new about this love? Jesus makes it very clear. This is going to be a different kind of love. Note the difference. He says, you're supposed to love one another as I have loved you. So you must love one another. It's not love your neighbor as yourself. That's a human kind of love. It's not treat people the way you want to be treated. The golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Jesus carries love to a new dimension. This is not a human love. This is not a natural love. This is not a self-gratifying love. The love that Jesus is talking about is a supernatural love. Jesus said, you're now supposed to love people as I loved you. In the same way that you've experienced from me forgiveness, in the same way that you've experienced from me the total sacrifice of my life, in the same way that I've loved you and I've led you and I've worked with you and I've prayed with you. And the disciples knew that all of that had happened. For 3.5 years, Jesus had been there and taught them and encouraged them and helped them when they failed and met every one of their needs. Now Jesus turns to his disciples and says, I will be gone and now you will take my place. Each and every one of you should be Jesus to his brothers. And he says the same thing to the church today. Your role, your responsibility in the church when it comes to love is to be no less than Jesus Christ to the people that are sitting around you, to the people that you come in contact with. You should love them at the level of commitment and sacrifice and care that Jesus would if he were sitting in your place. Can you imagine a church like that? Can you imagine a group of people that say, I will be Jesus to you. Whatever Jesus would say to you, I will say to you. Whatever Jesus would do for you, I will do for you. Whatever he would give for you, I will give for you. I am going to be Jesus Christ to you. Jesus is telling his disciples, I'm going away. They're saying, there's no way. We can't deal with this. What will we do without you? Who will love us? Who will care for us? Who will take care of us? And Jesus says, y'all will take care of each other. Rather than me being here and meeting all of your needs, 11-to-1, it will be 1-to-1, everyone in this room loving and caring for one another. Now that's a new deal. That's a different kind of a deal. Love one another as I have loved you. He goes on to say, this proves the truth about us in verse 35. By this all men will know that you are my disciples if you love one another. The demonstration that the world is looking for is, are we really like Jesus? We say in our purpose statement, Hill Country Bible Church is a family of believers committed to reaching people with the life-changing reality of Jesus Christ. And what we believe is that when Jesus Christ touches our lives, we are different people. Our lives are changed. We become like him. Now, should the world look at how we treat one another and see Jesus? Absolutely. You say, well, has this ever happened in history? Have there ever been a group of people that really loved each other this way? The truth is, the early church did. If you'll turn over a few pages to Acts chapter 2, I want you to see the model of the early church. Acts chapter 2, verse 42. Now, the group of people that are described in Acts chapter 2, verses 42 and following, are an interesting group of people. There were about 500 people that were associated with Jesus Christ and that believed in him and that saw him after the resurrection. And they, on the day of Pentecost, led by the disciples, stand up and preach a message to the masses. Now, the masses who are gathered there, who hear this message, are the very same people that just a few short days before have shouted, crucify him, crucify him. They hated Jesus, and they're the ones responsible for taking him to the cross. Peter preaches a message on the day of Pentecost, just a few days after Jesus dies on the cross. And on the day of Pentecost, 3,000 people of this crowd trust Jesus Christ, come into faith in Jesus Christ, and they all immediately take on these characteristics. Look at verse 42. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to the fellowship, to the breaking of bread and to prayer. Everyone was filled with awe, and many wonders and miraculous signs were done by the apostles. All the believers were together and had everything in common. Selling their possessions and goods, they gave to anyone as he had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with gladness and sincerity and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people. And the Lord was adding to their number daily those who were being saved. 3,000 people trust Jesus Christ and immediately begin to enmesh themselves in a lifestyle that's regularly, faithfully getting together, spending time together, eating together, growing in a relationship with one another. And they're so thoughtful and so concerned that they're selling their possessions in order to meet the needs of the poor people in that group. Does that continue? Turn over to Acts chapter 4. In Acts chapter 4, verse 32, we read these words. All the believers were one in heart and mind. No one claimed that any of his possessions was his own, but they shared everything they had. With great power, the apostles continued to testify to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and much grace was upon them all. There was no needy persons among them, for from time to time, those who owned lands or houses sold them, brought the money from the sale, and put it at the apostles' feet, and it was distributed to anyone who had need. You see, they took it seriously. When Jesus said, "Love as I have loved you," they remembered that Jesus had given up everything he had to take care of them. And it was their responsibility to do whatever they could to meet the needs of one another. And the people around were in awe. In fact, 100 years later, the church was still loving each other the way Jesus did. One of the non-Christians wrote a letter to Emperor Hadrian, the emperor of the Roman Empire at that time, and we have this letter recorded in history, and here's what he says about Christians. He says, "Oh, they love one another. They never fail to help widows. They save orphans from those who had hurt them. If they have something, they give freely to the man who has nothing. If they see a stranger, they take him home. And Hadrian, they are so happy, it must be their love." Now here's an outsider standing there, watching the Church of Jesus Christ and saying, "They're incredible. I've never seen anything like it." Jesus says, "By this all men will know that you're my disciples, if you have love for one another." Most of the time, the world looks at the church as a place that's full of unloving people, self-righteous, hypocritical, mean-spirited. That's exactly opposite of the attitude that Jesus Christ has called us to as a body of believers. He's called us to love one another with a self-sacrificial love. When you're teaching your children as a Christian parent, what are the priorities that you set for teaching them? Do you teach them to know the truth so that they can defend the faith? Do you teach them to live godly and righteous lives? Do you teach them to have character? Do you teach them to memorize Scripture? All of those things are good. But I would say that if you have not taught them how to love sacrificially, how to give above and beyond what would be considered normal, how to treat other people the way Jesus treats other people, how to love, you've missed the point. Of all the things that we need today, our children that are growing up in homes where they're taught not to be self-centered, not to just take care of their own needs, not just to satisfy their own desires, but children who grow up in homes where they see mom and dad doing things for other people, things that would be considered way outside of the ordinary, where they're serving and loving not to get something back, not to look good, not to make themselves feel happy, but they're serving to love and to help. And our children need to see that modeled in us. That's what Jesus calls his disciples to, a selfless love. Now we see the contrast. Peter's the contrast. In Peter, we see a self-centered loyalty. A self-centered loyalty. Notice in verse 36, Simon Peter asked him, "Lord, where are you going?" That must have been very frustrating for Jesus. He just got done saying, where I'm going, you cannot come. And then he says, a new commandment I give to you, love one another. You know, this is important, Peter. I mean, this is a big deal. It's a new commandment. It's something that hasn't been shared before. This is great stuff, Peter. Pay attention to this. And Peter's just completely out to lunch. He hasn't heard a word. The minute that Jesus said, I'm going and you can't follow me, Peter completely tuned out, because that's all he cares about is being with Jesus. He says, Jesus replies, where I'm going you cannot follow now, but you will follow later. Just an aside, that you will follow later, Jesus is going to death and to martyrdom. Peter will go to death and to martyrdom later on. In fact, John chapter 21 tells us that Peter's headed in that direction. Peter has no idea where this journey of his life is going to take him. Jesus says, you can't follow me right now. Peter doesn't hear anymore. He just speaks, verse 37, Lord, why can't I follow you now? I will lay down my life for you. Peter has got a self-centered loyalty. What Peter is saying is, Jesus, I don't care what you're telling me I'm supposed to do. I'm going to do what I want to do. And what I want to do is I want to be loyal to be with you. You've met all my needs. You've taken care of me. You've been there for me, and I'm going to be there with you. In fact, if it means dying, I'm willing to do that. But don't ask me to stay behind and live with these guys. You've got to be kidding me. Stay behind? Miss out on all the excitement? Miss out on going to the cross? I'm not going to miss out on any of that. I'm going to stay here with these guys? There's no way. In fact, the disciples have all been arguing just before this time about who's going to be the greatest in the kingdom, and now Jesus is telling them that they're going to love one another and they're going to replace him by loving each other. Peter says, there's no way. There's no possible way I'm going to stay here with these guys. I'll die with you. I'll lay down my life with you. What's he really saying? What Peter's really saying is, Jesus, I am loyal to you in the way that I want to be loyal to you, but I'm not going to obey what you're telling me. I do not want to stay here and love these guys. That's the furthest thing from my mind. I want to take the hard road. And we notice Peter's seems like he's willing to follow through on that when they get in the garden and Judas and the troops approach. What does Peter do? Reaches in his pocket and pulls out his little knife and whacks off the ear of the high priest's servant. I mean, he's out there. He's ready to take action. He's ready to do something, but don't tell me to love these guys. Meet their needs? Come on. I don't know if you ever feel that way. From time to time, I feel that way. Jesus, call me to something fantastic. Let me be loyal to you in the limelight. But don't ask me to wash somebody's feet. Not her, Lord. Not him. Meet their needs? They got themselves in trouble. Why should I step in? That's none of my business. Why should I love that way? Not me, Lord. Call me to do something great for you. Don't call me to do something little for someone else. That's what Peter's saying. Self-centered loyalty. Jesus' response cuts to the heart. In verse 38, Jesus speaks, and actually from the time Jesus speaks here, we never hear from Peter again until he responds by denying Jesus. Jesus answers, will you really lay down your life for me? I tell you the truth, before the rooster crows, you will disown me three times. Before the sun rises, Peter, you will disown me. Now, you think you can die with me? Not on your life. Can you live for me? That's the question. That's the question before us today. How loyal are we to Jesus? Are you loyal enough to Jesus to obey his command to love other people self-sacrificially? Do you see that demonstrated in your life? If it's demonstrated in your life, I believe that there'll be three ways that you'll see it clearly. And by way of application, the first is, you will love until it hurts. You will love until it hurts. Not hurts them, hurts you. Secondly, you will love until it helps them. And thirdly, you will love until it holds us together. We see that in Jesus Christ. He loved until it hurt. Jesus was willing to die for these guys. He was willing to die for the sins of the whole world. He was willing to suffer personal sacrifice and personal pain in order to meet the needs of these guys. And he turns and he says to us as the church, we need to be the kind of lovers who love until we give so much that we feel it, until we give so much that we notice that it's making a difference in our lives. Have you ever loved someone to the point where it cost you something? I'm aware today of two families in our church. There may be more than I'm not aware of, but there are at least two families in our church who've opened up their home to other people to come and live with them. In both of these situations, the families were suffering financial hardship, and they were in situations where they really didn't have a place to live. And there were families in our church who said, come live with us. Come live with us. Now, in a home, most of us have plenty to fill up our time. Schedules to meet, people to feed, stuff to clean, bedrooms that are full of kids. To invite another family to come and live with you for a period of time, that's a hardship. That requires sacrifice. That requires a willingness to give up your personal space, your personal freedom, and even your personal schedule to let another person in. That requires sacrifice. I think it's tremendous that we have people who are willing to love as Jesus loved. If you were Jesus Christ and one of your disciples needed a home, don't you think he'd put them up? How about you? Would you love until it hurts? I heard recently that during one of our care circles, our small groups, the phone rang and there was a family member calling for one of the members of that small group to tell him that his mother was about ready to die in Houston and he needed to come right away. Two of the other men in that small group said, we will not let you drive by yourself. And they jumped in the car and they drove that man at 9 o'clock on a weeknight with work looming the next morning, drove him 3.5 hours to Houston, and then they turned around and drove 3.5 hours back so that they could be with him so he wouldn't have to be alone at that difficult time. Now to me, that's an expression of self-sacrificial love, where a person is willing to put themselves out to meet the needs of another person. What that says is I love you like Jesus. You may feel alone and you may wonder where Jesus is in your time of need. Well, Jesus is right here with skin on. I will be Jesus Christ in your life when you need him. Jesus calls all of his disciples to love until it hurts. Not only love it till it hurts, but he also calls us to love until it helps. To love until it helps. So many people are struggling with their own growth. They're struggling with life. And it's so easy for us to get callous to all the needs that are out there. In fact, sometimes it's easy for us to say, why should I help them? I've got enough trouble in my own life. Why should I bother to help someone else? Where are they going anyway? I wonder if there were times when Jesus ever wondered if he was doing any good for his disciples. He spent 3.5 years with them and seemed like they constantly were failing. Every test that he gave them, it seemed like they failed over and over again. In fact, by the end of his life, Jesus was dealing with a group of guys that were still struggling as to who was going to be greatest in the kingdom. One of the commentators writing about Jesus' disciples and his love for them says it this way. He says, their leader, that is Simon Peter, was to deny him. They were all to forsake him in his hour of need. They never, in the flesh of his days, really understood him. They were blind and insensitive, slow to learn and lacking in understanding. And in the end, they were craven cowards. But Jesus held nothing against them. There was no failure which he could not forgive. Then he goes on to say, we are poor creatures, and there's a kind of fate in things which make us hurt most of all those who love us best. Oftentimes, when you love people, you'll find hurt in that. You'll love people who need your love and they won't acknowledge it. They won't say thank you. You'll find people who you pray for and you minister to and they do better for a while and then they go right back to their sin. And you stay with them and you stay with them and you wonder, is it worth it? Do I continue to show the love of Jesus Christ to somebody who doesn't seem to receive it and certainly doesn't deserve it? The answer to that question is yes. 1,000 times yes. Jesus Christ is long-suffering, and He loves and He continues to love, and we are called to love until it helps. To love until it helps. Love until it hurts us. Love until it helps them. And finally, love until it holds us. Jesus Christ was not just training an army. He was training a family. Those men were to become the family of God. And the Church of Jesus Christ is a family. And the key characteristic of a quality family is a commitment to love. And we must love one another until it holds us together, until we are tight with one another and we are bound together in the bond of love. During the Korean War, the phone rang one day in a fashionable home on the east coast of the United States, and to her astonishment, a mother was listening to her son, a soldier's voice, on the other end of the line. It had been months of silence as he had been at war in Korea, and she had not heard from him, and so to hear his voice just was astounding to her, and she was so elated to hear from him. He said, "Mom, I just wanted to let you know that I'm bringing a buddy home with me. He got hurt pretty badly, and he has only one eye, one arm, and one leg. I'd sure like him to live with us." "Sure, son," she replied. "He sounds like a brave man. We can find room for him for a little while." "Mom, you don't understand. I want him to come and live with us." "Well, okay," she relented. We could try it for 6 months or so." "No, Mom. I want him to stay with us always. He needs us. He's got one arm, one leg, and one eye. He's really in bad shape." His mother began to lose patience. She said, "Son, you're being pretty unrealistic about this. You're being emotional because you've been at war. This boy will be a drag on you and a problem for all of us. Be reasonable." Suddenly the phone clicked dead. A few days later, they received a call from the State Department asking them to come down to the military base and identify a body. It was the body of their son. He had committed suicide. They went down to the military base where they uncovered the remains of this young man, only to discover that in the battle he had lost one eye, one arm, and one leg. You see, the soldier that he was bringing home was himself. What he really wanted to find out from Mom and Dad: "Will you still love me with my war wounds?" People are asking the same question about the Church of Jesus Christ. You see, we all come in here with scars, with war wounds. The battles that we have fought, some we won and some we lost on the outside. And we're coming in and we're asking, "Are you going to love me with my scars?" I recently spent some time with a man who was struggling with a personal sin issue in his life. And I said, "You need accountability?" He said, "I know I need accountability." He says, "I want accountability. I need some help. I need some friends who will stick with me and hold me accountable so I won't fall back into the sin." I said, "Have you told your friends about it? Have you shared your problem with them?" He said these words to me. He said, "Tim, you've just got to be careful. You've got to be careful who you tell these things to. Because if you tell them, they may not care for you anymore. They may not love you." That is so unfortunate. Here's a person struggling with sin, needing help, wanting help, but fearful that when someone sees the wounds, he'll be rejected altogether. The Church of Jesus Christ must be a place where we love people until it holds them tightly, until they feel part of the family and they can find help, they can find security, they can find care, they can find spiritual nurture and growth where they can get their needs met. That's the kind of church that Jesus Christ has called us to be. Love until it hurts, love until it helps, and love until it holds. The question I have for you this morning: is there somebody in the world that would point to you and say, "There goes Jesus. There goes Jesus. That person has been Jesus in my life. That person loved me sacrificially. That person was there for me. That person met my needs. That person cared. That person cried. That person loved. That person held. That person gave of themselves. That's Jesus. That's Jesus. That's what each of us are called to. When Jesus said, I got a new commandment, here's a new deal for you, that you love like I love. What Jesus was really saying is you should become like Jesus to the other people in the family of faith. That's your calling. Are you reaching? Are you touching? Are you caring? Are you loving like Jesus loved? In a world without Jesus, how do we find love? How do we find care? We find it from one another as we love sacrificially. I received a letter a while back from a family that had attended Hill Country Bible Church and moved away. And here's what she writes. She says, we certainly do miss all of you. It was a change to move to Ohio and find ourselves homesick for Texas, not North Carolina. They grew up and lived in North Carolina all their lives until they moved to Texas. And the whole time they were here, they were homesick for North Carolina. Then they got moved to Ohio, and they're homesick for Texas. She says, but we have found a church, and like all things, it's different than what we're used to. But wasn't that how we felt at Hill Country Bible Church? Although the group is a little stuffy, we're finding that once you get them into your home, they can warm right up. And although they're a lot more casual than, or although we're a lot more casual than they are, they don't seem to mind a bit. Did you know that there's a difference between casual and dressy casual? We never cease to learn new things. And then she says this, it is certainly wonderful to move away from an area that you feel has given you tools to take to your next location. And the greatest of these was the love, the unconditional love that the body had for us and taught us to give in return. And all in His name, love, Kent and Belinda Patrick. That's what the church is all about. A place where we love sacrificially. Let me just make one more comment. I've heard people saying some strange things around here lately. Could be that first hour, we ran out of seats and had people standing in the back. You picked the right hour to come, second hour. Could be because we've got some new buildings, we've got a bigger staff or whatever, but what I've heard people say is that we're a big church. Hill Country is a big church. You know, I've pondered that comment, and you know what? I've come to the conclusion that that's not a biblical comment. You say, well, why is that not a biblical comment? Well, because if we look at the model of the New Testament church, you know, the model of the New Testament church, it started with 500, and on the day of Pentecost, they added 3,000. So the first day that the church opened its doors, it had 3,500 people. We're just a third of the size of the first church. And if that's our biblical model, then we're not really that big of a church at all. In fact, what I would say is Hill Country Bible Church is not a big church, it's a busy church. It's not a big church, it's a busy church. You know the reason why people like churches that have 200 people in them? The reason why people like those churches with 200 people is because they're lazy. They want it to be easy. They want to walk in the door and be able to easily scan the audience, see everybody they know, and before the service is over, without having to extend an extra 10 or 15 minutes, stop and visit with the people that they want to talk to and still be able to get to the cafeteria to beat the rush. And they feel connected because they've been able to talk to everybody in that group that was important to them in a short period of time, and they don't have to invest any time in their relationships. It's real easy that way. You know, two or three times a year, you have a group of people over and you visit with everybody in the church. And you feel so at home, makes it easy. Church gets a little bigger. Now you got to spend a little more time. You got to stretch a little bit. You've got to turn to the people next to you that you haven't seen before and shake their hand only to find out that they've been coming for 3 years and you've never met them. That takes a little more work. That takes a little more effort. And it also takes a willingness to commit yourself to get involved in the ministries of the church, like Sunday school, where you can get to know 25 or 30 other adults and build deep relationships with them. And care circles, where you meet regularly in the home with people and get to know them on an intimate, personal basis. That requires time. It requires commitment. And it requires love. Love for one another. We're not a big church. We're just busy people. And we want it to be easy. And you know what? Jesus Christ kind of love is never easy. It always requires sacrifice. And yet when we give, and when we receive, and when we become Jesus Christ to one another, we experience the heaven on earth, the pleasure that the church was intended to provide, until the day when we're all transported to join that huge heavenly family in the sky to be with Jesus Christ and experience that love forever and ever. My desire, and I hope yours is too, is that we will become Jesus to one another in love. Let's bow our heads and pray. Father in heaven, challenge our hearts this morning. Challenge our thinking. Help us to break out of old patterns and old molds and to open our hearts and open our eyes with love to one another. Father, I pray for that cold heart that's here this morning, that years and years and years of selfish living has caused those eyes just to focus on self and not on others. I pray that you would break through. I pray that you would build bridges. And I pray that you would cause that heart to have a passion to be Jesus Christ to other people here. And Father, I pray that all of us would exemplify and experience the love of Jesus Christ here at Hill Country Bible Church, that all men would know that at this place, we are your disciples because we love one another. Make it a reality here, Lord. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.